Tuesday version of the Mike Malloy program. We're not going to do a lot of church tonight. I've got some church coming up in the third hour that will surprise and amaze you. Stick around for that, huh? Too many things to get all church tonight, you know what I'm saying? April is the cruelest month, the poet said. Let's see, April 19th, 1993, the FBI siege of the Waco compound in Texas leaves 76 people dead. April 19th, 1995, bombing a federal building in Oklahoma City kills 168 people. April 20th, 1999, mass shooting at Columbine High School, 15 dead. April 16th, 2007, Virginia Tech massacre kills 33. And April 20th, last year, the BP Gulf oil explosion. And multiple instances of species death. People are starting to get sick and die now. And BP, hey, have I told you lately the oil company's profits are up 41%? April is the cruelest month. This hour is sponsored by, and there's no message here, right? Just Aaron Wright. Aaron, thank you very much for sponsoring this hour. It's very kind. McDonald's. You want to see the future of America? You saw it today. 50,000 workers. Is what McDonald's is looking to hire today. It's a one-day hiring spree. 50,000. 50,000 fast food clerks. McDonald's said these new jobs will include crew and management positions, part-time and full-time. McDonald's has 14,000 colon-destroying, heart-disease-causing, pancreas-destroying restaurants in the United States. Jan Fields, president of McDonald's USA, said, "We're excited to offer 50,000 new jobs all across America, all in one day." Jan Fields, she's a bootstrap lady. She started working in a McDonald's restaurant as a crew member in 1978, behind the counter. Yeah, I did that in 1958, as a matter of fact. 59. I did. I worked in McDonald's back when fries were 10 cents, hamburgers were 15, and a milkshake was 25. How old am I? No, it was a 40 cent All-American. Was that 40 cents? 25, 35, 50 cent All-American.
You have to count, you're too old.
What? What? Anyway, that's where the president of McDonald's started doing the same thing I did.
You worked at McDonald's number 4.
That's right. She said that, anyway, Jan Fields, the president of McDonald's, said the 50,000 new hires will increase the U.S. workforce to 50,000 new hires will increase McDonald's workforce just in the U.S. to 700,000. Happy burger flipping, french fry dipping, cholesterol sucking, heart attack causing employees. The average pay for the job? You ready? $8.30 an hour. Wow, that's $1.05 over the minimum wage. Jan Fields said the restaurant managers, now they're not hiring 50,000 of those, but the restaurant managers can make 50 grand a year. Did you know that there are 840,000 more Americans working for minimum wage this year than there was last? I guess a job is a job, though, right? 50,000. Let's see, $8.30 an hour. After taxes, call it $7 an hour. That would be, on a 40-hour work week, that'd be $280 a week, which would be $1,200, a little under $1,200 a month, which would be a little under $15,000 a year. What is the poverty level for a family of four? $27,000? So, $15,000, $16,000 a year working at McDonald's, 50,000 jobs. Wow. Man, think of all the people who are going to have jobs that pay 50%. I'm sorry, 70% of the poverty rate. God damn, this is a great country. I mean it. This is a great country. Woo! It is a great country! Where are those people going to buy their gasoline to get to and from work? $50,000 jobs at McDonald's. Well, there's even better news ahead here. I mean, we're just chock-a-block with good news tonight. From Kathy in Maine. Mike, once again, our illustrious Republican Governor LePage and his like-minded thugs in the Maine Congress are up to no good. Their target is now the laws to protect child labor here that were enacted in 1847. They want to unravel these protections to let kids work longer hours, work later into the night, and work for less than the minimum wage. Sounds like they may be attempting to create something like a third world workforce using the teenagers of Maine, which probably fits nicely into Governor LePage's pro-business plans for the state. In fact, their reasoning specifically displays their inability to comprehend what real family life may be like and how there are very few Norman Rockwell-type families around today. One of the co-sponsors of this bill that would strip away the long-standing child labor laws says, "The kids have parents. Let the parents be responsible. Let the parents take care of their kids." This guy believes that the government should get out of the way on child labor issues. In the Rethuglican mind, laws are not necessary and we must get the government out of the family. Unless it's about abortion in a woman's uterus, then the government needs to move right in. But I digress. We all know that all teenagers enjoy the most supportive of families. And of course, no employer would ever take advantage of a teen who really needs a job. Laws shouldn't protect people, according to these thugs. They just get in the way. One could ask, get in the way of what? Whatever they're up to, the Republicans here in Maine seem hell-bent on rolling back or shredding every gain ever made throughout history. I suppose their next target will be any of a number of hard-fought gains, including but not limited to women's right to vote, civil rights, food safety. To quote Eeyore, it keeps getting worser and worser. Kathy in Maine. Yeah, what are these child protection laws anyway? I mean, what child labor laws? I mean, my God, a hard-working, hungry, uneducated kid is the best kind of kid in a capitalist society. Just go to Bangladesh and take a look around. Go to, any of maybe 150 different countries here on tired, old, beat down, ready to die planet Earth. And take a look at these hardworking 9-year-olds. Is that the future of this country? We'll be right back.
Golden arches and take away the trees. Need some ashes and ransom mayonnaise. Put everybody out the pasture and let the people graze. Make them all submissive and take away their drive. Be the sign of the crucifix for the...
Good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
Yeah, 21 past the hour. Bradley Manning is being transferred from the Marine Brig at Quantico, Virginia to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, which is an Army base. Bradley Manning is a member of the United States Army. And regardless of what anyone would tell you to the contrary, this is in response to the international outcry over Manning's treatment. The official who speaks for the Marine Corps base at Quantico said an announcement will be made probably tomorrow at the Pentagon. Amnesty International's spokesperson said Manning's treatment violates human rights. A committee of Germany's parliament also protested about his treatment to the White House. A UN torture investigator said yesterday he's frustrated at being denied an unmonitored visit to Manning. Juan Mendez said the U.S. government, quote, that's the torture investigator, said the U.S. government, quote, has not been receptive to a confidential meeting, end quote, with PFC Bradley Manning. He said in a statement that a monitored conversation would be counter to the practice of his U.N. mandate. So Bradley Manning, according to CBS News, will be moved tomorrow to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. I don't know if, I opened AOL today, and I see this headline, Obama gets testy with reporter. that's how it's put up at AOL News. Apparently, Obama sat down for a series of interviews with local television outlets in Texas, and some little dude trying to make his name, right? You can just see this guy, Brad Watson of WFAA Television in Dallas, met with Obama in the White House to discuss the president's deficit plan and Texas politics. During this interview, Bradley Watson pressed Obama on his standing in the Lone Star State. Watson asked the president, why are you so unpopular in Texas? Oh, now this comes from ostensibly a television news reporter who has been allowed, a little creep like this, to interview Obama. And regardless of what I think about Obama's functioning as president, what's the line?
I may not like the president, but I respect the office.
Yeah, sure. Obama responded to that, why are you so unpopular in Texas, by claiming that Texas had historically leaned Republican. After a few more exchanges, Obama concluded the interview by telling Bradley, "Let me finish my answers the next time we do an interview, all right?" What happened was this little punk-ass television reporter kept interrupting. He'd ask a question, Obama would start to answer, and the little punk-ass would, interrupt. Because the punk-ass, first of all, he knows he's talking to a person of color, so there doesn't have to be any respect there. Can you imagine this little punk-ass doing this to George W. Bush? Or Dick Cheney? First of all, Bush never would have given the punk-ass an interview. And had he given the punk-ass an interview, and the punk-ass would have acted like this, Bush would have sent him to Guantanamo. But, the punk-ass, little Bradley from WFAA television, he knew he had one chance to make a name for himself, and he took it. Interrupting, just being a general all-around pissant where it concerns the President of the United States. Just, this reporter ask substantive questions? You want to know why? You want to know why this little punk, Brad Watson of WFAA Television in Dallas, you know why he asked, why are you so unpopular in Texas? Because he doesn't know what to ask. He doesn't have a clue. He has no idea what he's supposed to be doing sitting for an interview with the President of the United States, no matter who the President is. Why are you so unpopular in Texas, huh? Did you see what I did? You see what I did to the President? He didn't scare me. Didn't scare me a bit. I'm from Texas. We'll be right back. $8.25 an hour that McDonald's is going to pay, or $8.35, these 50,000 jobs. Prairie 2 reminds us that to match the buying power of 1938, was that 80 years ago? The minimum wage would need to be close to $14 an hour. It's actually about half of that. So, in order for people to, factor in 80 years of inflation, in order for people to exist on minimum wage today to the same level they existed in 1938, the minimum wage would have to be $14 an hour. And Prairie 2 adds, if the same standards of hours worked for unemployed statistics of 1938 were used today, most people that work for Ronald McDonald would be counted among the unemployed. But never mind. This is the new normal. I have a little bit of church coming up in the third hour, but here's a little bit of church. I think was it Irish Dave that sent this? I think so. This is a little bit of Bible study for this evening. 1 Samuel 18. verse 27. And David arose and went, he and his men, and killed of the Philistines 200 men. And David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he, David, might be the king's son-in-law. Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, as wife. So, the translation, David, a man after God's own heart, according to the Bible, King David, goes out and kills 200 men and brings their foreskins to King Saul in order to obtain King Saul's daughter as his wife. Now, David eventually has countless wives in the course of his lifetime, so many wives that no one really knows how many wives he had. But David uses extreme violence against another tribe to prove his manhood and qualifications to become attached to the royal household. Killed them all and cut off their foreskins. They must not have been Hebrews, I guess. Well, that's right. They were Philistines. Okay. So, the barbarism of the tribal desert warfare described in the Bible was pretty horrific. I mean, think about it. And yet David, King David, is an ultimate biblical hero to the Christians, second only to Jesus. We are led to believe that his one failure was that of adultery. That's a big no-no, though, in the Ten Commandments, right? Adultery and the murder of Uriah the Hittite. That was Bathsheba's husband. When, in fact, David did not show restraint when accumulating wives or attacking and murdering neighboring tribes. He was a man of war and violence. I don't see how it can be beneficial to teach young children about this biblical hero and let's... The church is wanting to continue world dominance through militarism and war and cutting off other people's foreskins. But I had no idea that Uriah Heep was doing music when King David was around. I'm not surprised, but speaking of the Christian God, apparently he is thoroughly pissed off at Texas. You see what's going on down there? 1.5 million acres of Texas has been burned to a crisp, and the fires are nowhere near being under control. Reuters news agency says the fires that have burned hundreds of thousands of acres are creeping closer to the Dallas-Fort Worth area today, burning upscale homes near a lake and threatening hundreds of more homes. The fires started in sparsely populated West Texas and have moved east, helped by bone-dry conditions and winds whipping up the flames. Oh, man. The fire has also closed the Possum Kingdom fish hatchery. Really? U.S. Forest Service firefighters, joined by 14 Texas State Park firefighters, continued to monitor Possum Kingdom State Park. Because apparently if that goes, I don't know what'll happen. Bad stuff. Somebody quick, call Rick Perry and ask him if he still is in a secession mode, because there's no reason for U.S. Forest Service firefighters to be down there. You know, these dumb bastards in Texas want to secede. Well, part of secession is, you know, you don't get the federal employees to come help you put out your fires, boys. You really don't. Oh, and by the way, if you do secede and Mexico decides they've had enough of your worthless asses after taking half of their country away and they start to attack you, I know you got Fort Hood down there, but that'll be closed up. Everything will be closed up and moved out. What are you going to do? Use the Texas Rangers? Yeah, okay. They'll send up about 1,000 of those murderous drug cartel thugs who, you know, cut the heads off of children for sport. send them up and get old Rick Perry and take a look at that good hair on Rick Perry, and shoo, his head will be on a pike someplace. Nah, Texas wants to get out of the Union. Hell yeah, boys, go ahead. Listen, give us back our U.S. Forest Service firefighters, will you please? You don't need them. You know, some of them folks might have voted for Obama. God. I don't know. It gets crazier and 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 crazier. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. What else we got here? I'm tempted to do this tonight. I think I may during the second hour. Got something from Prairie 2 here. What else we got? I got an email from Teresa. Mike, regarding your despair about America's American people's apparent apathy or passive compliance with the steady decline of our once great nation to the god of greed and selfishness, I want to point out that I make phone calls, write letters, and go to the occasional rally. But if I were to put as much time into all the things that I feel moved to be active about, it would consume all my waking hours and even cut into sleep time. I simply do not have the time. I do not work, but I'm so busy caring for my family, researching how my daughter can go to college with our limited financial resources, and advocating for and creating programs for my severely disabled 20-year-old son, which I've been doing since he was born. I just don't have the extra energy and time to do more than I'm already doing. I actually do more than anyone I know, and that's far less than I wish I could do. I bet there are a lot of people like me. You have to ask on a daily basis, is this going to be worthy of my efforts? Will it produce results? I must say, I have become disillusioned about the impact that an ordinary citizen can have on elected representatives. Until people get out in the streets in massive numbers, over and over, as they have in other countries of late, I don't think things will change. But what will get people out into the streets? I think many of us are already dancing as fast as we can, so to speak, but I can't give up hope. I still believe in the basic goodness of people, and although there may have to be a lot more suffering before things change, I believe the forces of good will overcome in the end. Teresa Marie, as a matter of fact. Yeah, I'm certainly aware that there are literally hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are dedicated to trying to change the system. And by change the system, I mean destroy the one that's currently in place. Because the one that's in place, this religio-fascism, cannot be reformed. Capitalism cannot be reformed. The predatory practices of the banking and financial industries in this country, on this planet, cannot be reformed. It cannot be done. It has to be destroyed and replaced. Very simply. And I think that is, I kind of read that in Teresa's letter. I believe in basic goodness of people, and although there may have to be a lot more suffering before things change, I believe the forces of good will overcome in the end. Yeah, the change that I think people are looking for is creative destruction in a communal sense, to destroy the very system that is eating all of us alive and replace it with something that makes sense. Radio.
Can't find a friend.
It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour, this hour has been sponsored by Aaron Wright. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you. Much appreciated sponsorship. Got an email today from Al Babe, the poet and writer formerly known as Al Gordon. And he sent along with the email something that I want to do next hour. Is a piece written by Mark Ames, and it first appeared at the Alternate website. It's really bizarre. Well, let me just share with you what Al Babe wrote. He said, Ayn Rand believed in the self, quote, quote, the self. Sounds good to most people, seeing as the only things we have in our lives is that self and our possessions. We all need to occasionally concentrate on our selves in our lives to get by and get things done. But Ayn Rand touted that this self was to be thought of and treated as a universe unto itself. She thought that thoughtful community was a bad thing, that altruism was, quote, incompatible with the requirements of human life and happiness, end quote. She compares altruism to cannibalism. Besides Ayn Rand's obvious sociopathic personality, her pseudo-philosophy is based on an inflated sense of self, the ego taken to the extreme. The very odd juxtaposition is that there are so many self-designated Christians, those teabagging, infantile slack jaws that tout her, when in point of fact, her sociopathic pseudo-philosophy is diametrically opposite to anything resembling being a Christian. Maybe I'm very deeply flawed, Al writes, but I just don't relate to these libertarians and objectivists. They are as alien as Alpha Centauri to me. I can't even imagine being devoid of even a minimal humanity. Their ideas seem very scary to me and are obviously deadly to anything like society, any society. I think life is sacred, whatever sacred means. I can't even kill a spider. I believe life is an amazing thing that should not be taken lightly. To these people, the baggers and the right-wing Christians and those sort, to these people, selfishness, complete self-involvement, and self-serving profit are the only sacred things. And they should be sought at the deadly expense of everything and everyone else. Ayn Rand was a sociopath, pure and simple. She was anti-community, unless she could financially benefit from it. She was anti-social programs like Social Security and Medicare until she herself needed them and used them. She was a chain-smoking female misogynist who eventually contracted lung cancer and died a very precisely hypocrite death. And so-called leaders like Paul Ryan think her and her so-called philosophy should be held on high and used as a template for social humanity. The following article is about Ayn Rand and about one of her real-life heroes, the man she modeled most of her superhuman, rugged male characters after. This is the kind of man that Mrs. Rand thought was the pinnacle of masculine humanity. There's a small part of this article that is rather gruesome. Beware. Al Babe. All right, now, he sent this to me, and I'm going to share it with you when we come back. Because it is a bit about Ayn Rand's life that I think every teabagger, remember that scene in what was the movie Ultraviolence, and the guy's eyes forced open to what was that movie? Oh damn.
Good
Somebody help me. The Clockwork Orange. That's right. So that was Stanley Kubrick, wasn't it? Yeah. In Clockwork Orange, there are sections of the film that are so crushingly violent, especially when it comes. When did it come out? 72? 71? Somewhere around in there. Just astonishingly violent. But a kind of violence that, at the same time, was just incredibly casual. And what I have discovered about Ayn Rand's life, since the teabaggers and some of these crazed Christians have turned her into some kind of a cult hero, what I have learned about her, every single thing I have learned has been shockingly, horrifyingly Clockwork Orange-ish. But what I found out today was just kind of puts Ayn Rand right up there with the droogs, the bully boys. You'll see what I mean when we come back. Stick around. This is going to be interesting. I'm Mike Molloy.
Jay Farner here.
This is the Molloy Program. This hour is sponsored by Carol and Paul, who dedicate this hour to Old Man in His Underwear, a progressive who knows how to get things done even as he faces the most daunting challenges. We love you, man. Old Man in His Underwear. I've gotten emails from him. Yeah, I have. So Carol and Paul sponsor tonight's program, or tonight's, this hour. And dedicated to Old Man in His Underwear, who knows how to get things done. Thanks, Carolyn Paul. Mark Ames. There's something deeply unsettling about living in a country where billions of people froth at the mouth at the idea of giving health care to tens of millions of Americans who don't have it, or who take pleasure at the thought of privatizing and slashing bedrock social programs like Social Security or Medicare. It might not be as hard to stomach if other Western countries also had a large, vocal chunk of the population who thought like this, but the U.S. is seemingly the only place where right-wing elites can openly share their distaste for the working poor. Where do they find their philosophical justification for this kind of attitude? Well, it turns out you can trace much of this thinking back to Ayn Rand, a popular cult philosopher who plays Charlie to the American right-wing's Manson family. Stick around here and you'll see why. One reason why most countries don't find the time to embrace her thinking is that Ayn Rand is a textbook sociopath. Literally a sociopath. Ayn Rand, in her notebooks, worshipped a notorious serial murderer dismemberer and used this killer as an early model for the type of ideal man that Rand promoted in her more famous books, ideas which were later picked up and put into play by major right-wing figures of the last half decade, including the key architects of America's most recent economic catastrophe, former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan and SEC Commissioner Christopher Cox, along with other notable right-wing Republicans such as Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, Rush Limbaugh, and South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. The loudest of all the Republicans, right-wing attack dog pundits, and the teabagger mobs fighting to kill health care reform and eviscerate so-called entitlement programs increasingly hold up Ayn Rand as their guru. Sales of her books have soared in the past couple of years. One poll ranked Atlas Shrugged as the second most influential book of the 20th century after the Bible. So what and who was Ayn Rand for and against? The best way to get to the bottom of it is to take a look at how she developed the superhero of her novel, Atlas Shrugged, John Galt. Back in the late 1920s, as Ayn Rand was working out her philosophy, she became enthralled by a real-life American serial killer, William Edward Hickman, whose gruesome, sadistic dismemberment of a 12-year-old girl named Marion Parker in 1927 shocked the nation. Rand filled her early notebooks with worshipful praise of Hickman. According to biographer Jennifer Burns, author of Goddess of the Market, Rand was so smitten by Hickman that she modeled her first literary creation, Danny Renahan, the protagonist of her unfinished first novel, The Little Street, on him, the mass killer. What did Rand admire so much about Hickman? His sociopathic qualities. She wrote, quote, "Other people do not exist for him, and he does not see why they should." She wrote that gushing that Hickman had, quote, "no regard whatsoever for all that society holds sacred, and with a consciousness all his own, he has the true innate psychology of a superman. He can never realize and feel other people," end quote. This echoes almost word for word Rand's later description of her character Howard Roark, the hero of her novel The Fountainhead. Quote, "he was born without the ability to consider others," end quote. By the way, The Fountainhead is Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's favorite book. He even makes his clerks read it. I'll get to where Rand picked up her silly Superman blather from, where she picked it up from later, but first, let's meet William Hickman. The, quote, "genuinely beautiful soul," she called him, an inspiration to Ayn Rand. What you will read below, the real story, details included, of what made Hickman a superman in Ayn Rand's eyes, is rather gory reading, even if you're a longtime fan of true crime death porn. So prepare yourself. Because you should read this to give Rand's ideas their proper content. Or context, and to repeat this over and over until all of America understands what made this effed up Russian nerd's mind tick. Because Rand's influence over the very people leading the fight to kill social programs, and her ideological influence on so many powerful bankers, regulators, and businessmen who brought the financial markets crashing down, means that it's suicide to ignore her, no matter how dumb, silly, or beneath you her books and ideas are. Rand fell for William Edward Hickman in the late 1920s as the shocking story of Hickman's crime started to grip the nation. His crime, trial, and case was a nonstop headline grabber for months, sort of the O.J. Simpson of his day. Hickman, who was only 19 when he was arrested for murder, was the son of a paranoid schizophrenic mother and grandmother. His schoolmates said that as a kid, Hickman liked to strangle cats and snap the necks of chickens for fun. Most of the kids thought he was a budding maniac, though the adults gave him good marks for behavior, a typical sign of sociopathic cunning. He enrolled in college, Hickman did, but quickly dropped out and quickly turned to violent crime, largely driven by the thrill and arrogance typical of sociopaths. In a brief and wild crime spree that grew increasingly violent, Hickman knocked over dozens of gas stations and drugstores across the Midwest and west to California. Along the way, it's believed he strangled a girl in Milwaukee and killed his crime partner's grandfather in Pasadena, tossing his body over a bridge after taking his money. Hickman's partner later told police that Hickman told him how much he'd like to kill and dismember a victim someday. And that day came for Hickman. One afternoon, Hickman drove up to Mount Vernon Junior High School in Los Angeles and told administrators that he'd come to pick up the Parker girl. Her father, Perry Parker, was a prominent banker. Hickman didn't know the girl's first name, so when he was asked which of the two Parker twins, Hickman answered, the younger daughter. And then he corrected himself, the smaller one. The school administrator fetched young Marion and brought her out to Hickman. No one suspected his motive. Marion obediently followed Hickman to his car, as she was told where he... She followed him to his car, as she was told, where he promptly kidnapped her. He wrote a ransom note to Marion's father, demanding $1,500 for her return, promising that the girl would be left unharmed. Marion was terrified into passivity. She even waited in the car for Hickman when he went to mail his letter to her father. Hickman's extreme narcissism comes through in his ransom letters as he refers to himself as a mastermind and not a common crook. Hickman signed his letters The Fox because he admired his own cunning. Fox is my name. Very sly, you know. And then he threatened, get this straight. Your daughter's life hangs by a thread. William Edward Hickman is who I'm reading about here. He was Ayn Rand's model for her characters, Galt, Rourke, the supermen that Ayn Rand put out there for brain-dead morons like Rush Limbaugh and Neil Bortz and these teabag freaks who have no idea about Ayn Rand. Nothing. They haven't a clue. More about this when we come back. William Edward Hickman, Ayn Rand's first true love.
Mr. Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour, Ayn Rand and her first true love, the man that she called a wonderful human being, an individual, a man who thought for himself, and the person upon whom she based her most famous male characters, Robert Rourke and John Galt. Howard Rourke, I'm sorry, and John Galt. Anyway, getting back to it, written by Mark Ames. Hickman, William Edward Hickman, and the girl's father, the girl he had kidnapped, exchanged letters over the next few days as he arranged the terms of the ransom, while Marion obediently followed her captor's demands. She never tried to escape the hotel where he kept her. Hickman even took her to a movie, and she never screamed for help. She remained quiet and still as told when Hickman tied her to the chair. He didn't even bother gagging her because there was no need to, right up to the gruesome end. Hickman's last ransom note to Marion's father is where the story reaches its disturbing apex. Hickman fills the letter with hurt anger over her father's suggestion that Hickman might deceive him and, quote, ask you for your $1,500 for a lifeless mass of flesh. I am base and low, but won't stoop to that depth, he said, Hickman said. What Hickman didn't say was that as he wrote the letter, Marion was already several chopped up lifeless masses of flesh. Why taunt the father? Why feign outrage? This sort of bizarre taunting was all part of the serial killer's thrill, maximizing the sadistic pleasure he got from knowing that he was deceiving the father before the father even knew what happened to his daughter. But this was nothing compared to the thrill Hickman got from murdering the helpless 12-year-old Marion Parker. Here's a newspaper description of the murder taken from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette on December 27, 1927. Quote, it was while I was fixing the blindfold that the urge to murder came upon me, he continued, and I just couldn't help myself. I got a towel and stepped up behind Marion. Then before she could move, I put it around her neck and twisted it tightly. I held on, and she made no outcry except to gurgle. I held on for about 2 minutes, I guess, and then I let go. When I cut loose the fastenings, she fell to the floor. I knew she was dead. Well, after she was dead, I carried her body into the bathroom and undressed her, all but the underwear, and cut a hole in her throat with a pocket knife to let the blood out. Another newspaper account dryly explained what Hickman did next. Then he took out a pocket knife and cut a hole in her throat. Then he cut off each arm to the elbow. Then he cut her legs off at the knees. He put the limbs in a cabinet. He cut up the body in his room at the Bellevue Arms Apartments. Then he removed the clothing and cut the body through at the waist. He put it on a shelf in the dressing room. He placed a towel in the body to drain the blood. He wrapped up the exposed ends of the arms and waist with paper. He combed back her hair, powdered her face, and then, with a needle, fixed her eyelids. He did this because he realized that he would lose the reward if he did not have the body to produce to her father. End quote. Hickman packed her body, limbs and entrails into a car and drove to the drop-off point to pick up his ransom. Along the way, he tossed out wrapped-up limbs and innards, scattered them around Los Angeles. When he arrived at the meeting point, Hickman pulled Marion's head and torso out of a suitcase and propped her up, her torso wrapped tightly to look like she was alive. He sewed wires into her eyelids to keep them open so that she'd appear to be awake and alive. When Marion's father arrived, Hickman pointed a sawed-off shotgun at him, showed Marion's head with the eyes sewn open. It would have been hard to see for certain that she was dead, and then took the ransom money and sped away. As he sped away, he threw Marion's head and torso out of the car, and that's when the father ran up and saw his daughter and screamed. This, then, is the, quote, amazing picture, end quote, Ayn Rand, guru to the Republican Tea Party right wing, admired when she wrote in her notebook that Hickman represented, quote, the amazing picture of a man with no regard whatsoever for all that a society holds sacred and with a consciousness all his own, a man who really stands alone in action and in soul. Other people do not exist for him, and he does not see why they should. End quote. Still there? You haven't left the room? This is Ayn Rand's hero. This is the man on whom she modeled Howard Roark and Robert Galt. Her Superman heroes. These are the people that the teabaggers admire, and they don't even realize it. A child-murdering sociopath made into a god by an atheistic Russian who came to this country and wrote two of the most sickening, vile novels ever produced. And the teabaggers, they love her.
Bang, bang, bang. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, 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 bang. I love the way you walk, and I love the way you talk.
Where is the outrage? Oh, here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, Mark Ames wrote a piece at Alternet about the sociopathology of Ayn Rand. Not a good novelist at all, but who wrote something that appealed to the kind of fascist undercurrent that runs rampant in this society, and also to the utter selfishness and egomaniacal attitude that the current crop of right-wing Christo-fascists seem to revel in. You know, they're just very happy to tell poor people and old people and dark people and young people and old people to just piss off so that they can grab more and more and more. Anyway, Ayn Rand's first big hero and the person upon whom she based some of her ideal man characters was a serial killer who dismembered children. Anyway, Ayn Rand made the point that Hickman represented, quote, the amazing picture of a man with no regard whatsoever for all that a society holds sacred and with a consciousness all his own, a man who really stands alone in action and in soul. Other people do not exist for him, and he does not see why they should, end quote. This was her exaltation of a mass killer who dismembered a 12-year-old. Back to what Mark wrote. Other people don't exist for Ayn Rand either. Part of her ideas are nothing more than a ditzy dilettante's bastardized Nietzsche. But even this was plagiarized from the same pulp newspaper accounts of the time. According to an LA Times article in late December 1927, headlined, Behavioralism Gets the Blame, a pastor and others close to the Hickman case denounced the cheap, trendy Nietzschean ideas that Hickman and others latch onto as a defense. Quote, this is how the article begins. Behavioristic philosophic teachings of eminent philosophers such as Nietzsche and Schopenhauer have built the foundation for William Edward Hickman's original rebellion against society, end quote. The article begins. Now, the fear that some felt at the time was that these philosophers' dangerous yet nuanced ideas would fall into the hands of lesser minds who would bastardize Nietzsche and poison the rest of us, which aptly fits the description of Ayn Rand, whose philosophy developed out of her admiration for, quote, supermen, end quote, like Hickman. Rand's philosophy can be summed up by the title of one of her best-known books, The Virtue of Selfishness. She argues that all selfishness is a moral good, and all altruism is a moral evil, even, to use her words, moral cannibalism. To her, those who aren't like-minded sociopaths are parasites and lice and looters. But with Rand, there's something more pathological at work. She's out to make the world more sociopath-friendly so that people like Ayn and her hero, William Hickman, can reach their full potential, not held back by the morality of the weak, whom Rand despised. That's what makes it so creepy, how Rand and her followers clearly get off on hating and bashing those they perceive as weak. Rand and her followers have a kind of fetish for classifying weaker, poorer people as parasites and lice who need to be swept away. This is exactly the sort of sadism, bashing the helpless for kicks, that Rand's hero Hickman would have appreciated. What's really unsettling is that even former central bank chief Alan Greenspan, whose relationship with Rand dated back to the 1950s, did some parasite bashing of his own. In response to a 1957 New York Times book review slamming Atlas Shrugged, Greenspan defending his mentor, published a letter to the editor that ends, quote, Parasites who persistently avoid either purpose or reason perish as they should, signed Alan Greenspan. As much as Ayn Rand detested human parasites, there is one thing she strongly believed in, creating conditions that increase the productivity of her supermen, the William Hickmans who rule her idealized America. She wrote, quote, if people place such things as friendship and family ties above their own productive work, yes, then they are immoral. Friendship, family life, and human relationships are not primary in a man's life. A man who places others first above his own creative work is an emotional parasite, end quote. And yet Republican faithful like Republican Congressman Paul Ryan read Ayn Rand and declare with pride, Rand makes the best case for the morality of democratic capitalism. Indeed. Except that Ayn Rand also despised democracy, as she declared, quote, democracy, in short, is a form of collectivism, which denies individual rights. The majority can do whatever it wants with no restrictions. In principle, the democratic government is all-powerful. Democracy is a totalitarian manifestation. It is not a form of freedom, end quote. Collectivism is another one of those Randian epithets popular among her followers. Here, for example, is another Republican member of Congress, the one with the freaky thousand-yard stare, Michelle Bachmann, parroting the Ayn Rand ideological line to explain her reasoning for wanting to kill social programs. Quote, Michelle Bachmann, as much as the collectivist says to each according to his ability, to each according to his need, that's not how mankind is wired. They want to make the best possible deal for themselves, end quote. Whenever you hear politicians or teabaggers dividing up the world between producers and collectivism, just know that those ideas and words more likely than not are derived from the deranged mind of a serial killer groupie. When you hear them threaten to go, John Galt, hide your daughters and tell them not to talk to any strangers or Tea Party Republicans. And when you see them taking the razor blades to the last remaining programs protecting the middle class from total abject destitution, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and brag about their plans to slash them for moral reasons, just remember Ayn's morality and who inspired her. Too many critics of Ayn Rand would rather dismiss her books and ideas as laughable, childish, hackneyed, lame, embarrassing. Nietzsche for sorority girls was how I used to dismiss her. I did that with the Christian right, like a lot of people who didn't want to take on something as big, bland, and impervious as them. Too many of us focused elsewhere until it was too late and the Christian fundamentalist crazies took over America. So this time, I'm paying more attention, late as usual, but maybe there's still time to head off the worst that's yet to come, because Ayn Rand's name keeps foaming out of the mouths of the teabagger crowd in the elite conservative circuit in Washington. Ayn Rand is the guru, and they are the Rand family. Followers carrying out her vision. The only way to protect ourselves from this thinking is the way you protect yourself from serial killers. Smoke the Rand followers out, make them answer for following the crazed ideology of a serial killer groupie, and run them the hell out of town and out of our hemisphere. Mark Ames. Writing at alternet.org, if you want your own personal copy. Yeah, there is so much that is so social pathology is what I'm trying to say, amongst these teabaggers. I've never seen a political movement like this in my life. To compare them to the Nazi brown shirts is a waste of time. To compare them to communist goose steppers is ridiculous. To compare them to any known ideological brand of crazy person, insane person, power mad, sick, degenerate, self-referential freak like, say, Neil Bortz is a waste of time. These people are unique. Truly. The whole teabag crowd. And I will guarantee you, I'll bet you $1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 hashtag rally and say, give me a quick synopsis, if you would, please, about Atlas Shrugged. They'll look at you and their mouths will open, or open a little wider, because most of these people are mouth breathers. They'll open their mouths a little bit wider and then shake their sign at you that will have at least one, possibly two misspelled words on it. Something about Barack Obama was born in Kenya. And yet these people are electing others like them. Are you aware of that? So the biggest hero, political hero these days, is to the real fringe crazy people in this country, and they are legion. They're all over the place. The biggest hero to these freaks is a woman who admired, lusted after, wrote her characters based on a serial killer who dismembered a 12-year-old for sport. Son of a bitch!
It is knowledge itself. How to Know God, page 130.
They brainwash my great uncle, brainwash my cousin Bob. They even got my grandma when she was working for the mob. Brainwash you while you're sleeping, while in your traffic jam. Brainwash you while you're weeping, while still a baby in your prime.
It's more Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, and, you know, sticking with this miserable topic a little bit longer, the teabaggers, as ignorant as they are collectively, and all you have to have done is look at some of the YouTube interviews of these freaks when they were holding their rallies against health care. I mean, rallying against health insurance reform. I mean, there are a million things to rally against, right? But to stage these hate-filled, bobble-headed events because I don't even know how to phrase it, because health insurance reform was in the offing. It was on the table. It didn't go anywhere. There, obviously, there are a few improvements, I think, that came out of the Obama plan or the Democrat plan or whoever's plan it was. But it's a far cry from what this society should have, which is single-payer health care. But to hold rallies and to make crap up, I mean, just to come out and lie, just like John Kyle. I've said before, every one of these miserable bastards lies through his or her teeth. They all do. But how do you get several million people, even in a twisted society like the one we live in, how do you get several million people to fawn over an atheist, communist, immigrant from Russia? Not that I don't have anything against Russians, except any writer, Russian, Slobovian, I don't care who it is, who comes here and writes a couple of books that are touted by her and her group of mouth-breathing followers as being some great revelation into the efficient working of the human soul. when in fact what she has written is murderous garbage, then I have no respect. I don't care where she's from. But none of these baggers, not one of these dumb bastards, has a clue as to who it is they're worshiping as they stand in their little clutches of ignorance in these rallies, while some freakish broad like Michelle Bachmann stands up there and as a member of the United States Congress talks about her worship of this crazy psychopathic writer. Kathy was out and about today. She came back and she said, you know, I switched over to the AM side of the radio just for the hell of it. Got off of Sirius and went to AM radio. And Neil Bortz was on. And so I started listening to him. I got home and I couldn't get out of the car because you know what he was. I had to keep listening. You know what he was saying? I said, I don't want to hear it. Neil Bortz is a goddamn subhuman. He is just, I don't know. He turns my stomach. I can't even say his name without getting a rush of nausea. No, no, you got to hear this, she said. He said that rich people should have more votes than poor. This one man or one person, one vote thing is crapola. And Bortz went on to say, you know, make $100,000 a year, you get a vote. Make up to $200,000, you get two votes. All the way up to five votes. People who don't have money shouldn't have as much to say about how the country is run. And of course, Neil Bortz has always touted his worship of Ayn Rand. His fawning. I remember when Ron Paul? When Ron Paul ran on the Libertarian ticket for president 15 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever it was, I thought Neil Bortz was going to have, I don't know, some kind of massive sexual release right on his radio program. He and I worked at the same radio station at the time. I mean, he was just beside himself with joy and glee. It was embarrassing being in the same building with this freak. But Bortz has always been somebody who, if he could, you know, if Howard Roark were a real person, you'd see Bortz down on his knees in front of Roark, worshiping him, of course. That's all I meant by that. But how does this happen in a country like this? Well, the answer is obvious. This country is sinking into a morass of craziness, lies, deception, a separation of the ultra wealthy from the rest of society, a governance that is run by corporations. Read Chris Hedges. Just go to chrishedges.something and read anything the man has written. Or listen to this program. Coming up next hour. Yeah, I know. You know all about it. What Jan Brewer did today, the governor of Arizona. And also some interesting stuff here, I think, about teachers in Michigan. I'm going to tell you, we have some rocky times in front of us until we decide to, in Ayn Rand's words, in Neil Bortz's words, eliminate the lice and the parasites. You know who I'm talking about, don't you, Truth Seeker? We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. Before I get to this madness in Arizona and the Gulf Coast, this hour is brought to you by Paul and Carol, or Carol and Paul. They want to dedicate this hour to Old Man in His Underwear, who cracks Malloy's invisible whip against evil, even as he faces daunting challenges that would crush a lesser man. Old Man in His Underwear. I get emails from him. So this hour is dedicated to him from Paul and Carol, who cracks Malloy's invisible whip against evil. All right, well, that's cool. Thanks, Paul and Carol. Old Man in His Underwear. Way to go, dude. Old Man in His Underwear. I like that. Hey, did you know oil company profits are up 41%? Did you remember last night I suggested you think about that when you go to gas up for that $4 and whatever cents a gallon gasoline? 41%. Governor Jan Brewer has sealed her fate. She will never be reelected in the state of Arizona or any place because she did something totally rational. Totally rational. Yeah, Governor Jan Brewer, the Republican, up to this point, psychopathic governor of Arizona. Sociopath. Whatever. Crazy person. As you know, we've been following these two stories. A bill allowing guns in Arizona on university campuses. And the second one was a bill passed by, you know, the legislature in Arizona that would require presidential candidates who want to appear on the ballot in Arizona to provide all sorts of proof about where they were born. Oh, Jesus, God. Well, both of these bills became, well, both of these ideas became bills, and the bills were passed on. Now, Jan Brewer is a strong advocate of gun rights. She would like to, you know, one assumes that strong advocates of gun rights are the types who see these signs outside of elementary schools that say, you know, guns within 100 yards of the school, it's a felony, that's somehow a violation of a person's civil rights to deny carrying a gun into a classroom full of 9-year-olds. You know, that's the way gun advocates think. Gun advocates think that a multi-round clip, 32 rounds in the in a Glock 9mm makes wonderful sense. Gun advocates think that semi-automatic or fully automatic assault weapons used to storm presidential palaces is okay for people to, you know, carry around on the street. Gun advocates are crazy. They're out of their freaking minds. They have no life. 90% of them are men. The women who are gun advocates do so because they've been beaten, pounded into that shape by their man. And I maintain, and always will maintain, that every single man who is a gun advocate, as defined in this sick culture, is someone who worries about the size of his penis. And the gun is an extension thereof, or thereunto, or thereabout, or whatever. No, I do. I honestly believe that. Now, someone that wants to own a gun and just shut the hell up, you know, you want to keep a rifle in case you want to go kill little, you know, cuddly little animals in the forest. Okay. You want a shotgun in case you want to go kill, a pheasant or, you know, ducks or something. Okay. You want to keep a handgun in your house in case some insane Republican son of a bitch tries to break in some night to steal your food? Okay. But that's not being a gun advocate. That's just being somebody who shuts up, and if they want to own a gun, they own a gun. And they license it, and they register it, and they register themselves, and they submit to fingerprints and gun registration numbers, and they do all that because, you know why? Because that makes sense. The gun nuts are the ones that say, the gun advocates are the ones that say, oh, well, if you do that, then when a Negro takes over the government, they'll come and get your gun and you. Oh, Jesus. God, I get sick of this. Anyway, that's definition of gun advocate. They're crazy. Like Wayne DePeter, the head of National Rifle Association, Wayne DePeter is out of his mind. He's totally beady-eyed, four-eyed, and I wear glasses too, so don't send me an email saying, Mike, you shouldn't talk about people who wear glasses. Four-eyed freak. Every time I see Wayne DePeter, he goes by Wayne LaPierre. Every time I see Wayne DePeter, he just looks to me like he's wet. I don't know why. He just always appears wet. Like sweating or I don't know, from breathing too hard or something. But Wayne DePeter is a perfect example of a gun advocate. This crazy coot won't be happy until a law is passed so the Christians can take a gun to heaven when they die. There's got to be something. When I rapture, I know I won't have any clothes on and I'll be hanging, so to speak, in the air. But I need my gun, because you know, on the way up to heaven, you might meet somebody who, you know, tries to mug you. So someplace, somewhere, somehow, you watch, somebody like Wayne DePeter is going to try to get a law passed that says the rapture shall not be gun free. The rapture shall not be a gun free zone. It'll happen. It'll come. Anyway, but I digress. I don't like gun advocates because I think they're all kind of wet looking and weird and shaky and stupid, and they don't use common sense at all. If you can't use common sense about a gun, if you can't do that, you're liable to do anything insane, like vote Republican or, you know, believe in sky spooks and all this other stuff. But I digress from my digression. Let me get back to Jan Brewer, the governor of the great state of Arizona. Governor Jan vetoed the gun measure. She did. Governor Jan vetoed the birther bill.
We wouldn't need the police no more because everybody would have a gun.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
C-SPAN, so you don't have to. It's More Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Hey, did you know oil company profits are up 41%? Whew, wow. Is this a great country or what? I mean, anyway, back out in Arizona, so Governor Jan Brewer says no, vetoes two bills that the mouth breathers out there were just getting sexually aroused about, first of all, was the ability to carry guns onto school campuses. That's real necessary part of education. And the second one was to insist that anyone who wanted to run for president of the United States and have their name appear on the Arizona ballot, by God, would have all kinds of documentation proving they were born here and not in Kenya. And also proof that they really were white. And she vetoed both of those. You know, the idea of going to school to learn rather than going to school to show off your new weapon is, I realize in some parts of the country that's a foreign concept. Just like in some parts of the country. I think, is it in Utah now, you can carry a gun to church to worship your Lord and Savior. You just take a gun with you and you'll feel secure. I mean, after all, you're sitting amongst, when you're in a church, you're sitting amongst people who hear voices in their head. You're sitting among people who believe in things flying through the air and demons and bad stuff. So probably you should be armed when you go into a church. You're walking into a room full of crazy, demented people. So I guess you should. That's a different topic, though. Governor Jan Brewer, whose political career is now ended, because she lives in the land of crazies, she said it was a desire to spare additional problems for Arizona that prompted her to veto the so-called birther bill. That bill would have, you know, like I mentioned, would have required presidential candidates to present all sorts of long-form birth certificates and documents and signed statements and witnesses. And, you know, you have to have at least five white people attest to the fact that you really were a white, well, you know. And she just decided that that would be, you know, a little too much stuff to do. In her veto statement, she said, quote, regarding the birther bill, quote, I never imagined being presented with a bill that could require candidates for president of the greatest and most powerful nation on earth. Oh, please. To submit, quote, early baptismal or circumcision certificates, end quote, among other records to the Arizona Secretary of State. This is a bridge too far, end quote. A bridge too far? Yeah, remember we talked about circumcision? Now, of course, Hillary would have had a problem with that. Hillary Clinton, how do you provide? Now, I realize there's something referred to as female circumcision. It is not. Specifically, penile circumcision, obviously. But can you imagine a female candidate? Maybe Jan Brewer was thinking about when she makes her bid for the president's office. How is she going to provide a circumcision? She's not even Jewish. A circumcision certificate, right? Would have been a little bit too far, or as she calls it, a bridge too far. Mm. On the gun measure, a state senator there, some freak named Ron Gould. Oh, it's got a D on it. Gould. Well, same thing. Ron Gould, a Republican from Lake Havasu City, argued that students and professors were vulnerable to armed attackers. And should not have their Second Amendment rights restricted. On campus. Ron is the one. Arizona State Senator Ron Gould is the one who is now going to introduce a bill saying that on the day of the rapture, things have to be changed so that naked bodies ascending into the Lord's presence will be able to take their weapons with them. Because, as I pointed out, you don't know who you're going to meet on that great getting up morning, huh? Flying up through the air? So, a requirement in early versions of the gun bill said that those carrying weapons on campus had to complete a concealed weapons training course. You know what that was? This is a coat. Inside the coat is a secret pocket. This is where you put your death weapon. You put it in there. Any questions? Okay, you all passed. Arizona right now leaves it up to the state's colleges and universities to set their own policies on firearms. And guess what? Guess what? This shows you how far into the liberal slime academia has sunk in Arizona. All the institutions of higher education in the state of Arizona ban guns.
What bothers you?
Psst. You're listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
Hey, by the way, did you know that oil company profits are up 41%? 41%? God, what a business, huh? Message from our sponsors for this third hour of the program tonight, Carol and Paul. They want to dedicate this hour to Old Man in His Underwear, who cracks Malloy's invisible whip against evil, even as he faces daunting challenges that would crush a lesser man. Carol and Paul, thank you. Old Man in His Underwear, you obviously are famous since this was the second hour dedicated to you tonight. We mentioned last night that Governor Rick Snyder of Michigan is literally ending democracy in that poor benighted state. Ah, Michigan. Oh, my God. Michigan. The auto industry. If you're over a certain age, think back. Think back. I mean, in September, two things happened. Way back. Two things happened in September. Kids started going back to school. Oh, yeah, believe it or not, we used to not go back to school until September after Labor Day. Can you imagine that? Two things happened way back in the day in September. You go back to school, the anticipation would start to build about the new models coming from Detroit. How big were the Finns going to be this year? Oh, my God, 55 Chevy, 57 Chevy. 57 Chevy just broke everybody's heart. All of us 16-year-old boys, it just absolutely broke our hearts. Or 14-year-old boys, broke our hearts because it was just beautiful. Oh, my God. But you waited with bated breath for the announcement from Detroit, Michigan. I mean, the whole country waited. What was Chevy coming out with? What about Ford? How about Chrysler Plymouth? What about Hudson? What about Studebaker? What were they coming out with this year? I remember the year Studebaker came out with the Avanti. Avanti. And the guy I was working for at the time, I had an after-school job, he bought one because he was fabulously wealthy. He bought an Avanti. And one day, this poor fool allowed me to drive it from Toledo, Ohio to Lima, Ohio, which is approximately 90 miles. And I got that Avanti out on Route 25, and the little bits and pieces of I-75 that were in place at the time. And I drove that thing 130 miles an hour. It was like driving a supersonic coffin. And I knew that. So, 130, I just stayed there for about 10 seconds and then backed off. But I digress again. I'm sorry. I'm just digressing all over the place tonight. I started talking about Michigan. Everybody waited in September for the new model cars to be announced. Oh, my God, did you wait? Usually they would show up in Look magazine or in a auto show someplace. But you knew it was coming, and the anticipation was palpable. I mean, it just, the entire country, this was a car society. We were the United States of America. We were building interstate highways. Hallelujah! And California car scene, oh, don't even. I mean, it was just, we were car crazy. Everybody in the United States was car crazy. I don't care. Everybody. Even the people who back then remembered horses and buggies. They still have got Michigan. Michigan. Michigan was strange because this is where the genius of automobile design came from. This is where the genius of cars that would get 12 miles a gallon. This is where the genius of the whole car culture originated. Detroit, Michigan. Nowhere else on earth. Volkswagen? What are you talking? Get out of here. Detroit. Detroit, Michigan. And for most of us in a part of the Midwest, Detroit, Michigan was the magnet. Not Chicago, not New York City, Detroit. And now look what has happened. Detroit now has a communist, no, not a communist, a totalitarian government. Run by a totalitarian governor who is practicing some of the worst aspects of capital C communism, the kind practiced by Stalin, Brezhnev. Who is the other one? Khrushchev. Governor Rick Snyder of Michigan came up with the idea of the Emergency Financial Manager, an EFM. Emergency Financial Manager was given the authority by the Georgia legislature under the firm hand of Governor Rick. The Emergency Financial Manager has all the power, plus, I mean, this is a communist commissar's wet dream. I mean, here is a state in the United States where the chief executive now has the power to do away completely just by issuing an order. Do away completely with the electoral process. You have a mayor? Sorry, I don't like him. He's out. You have a school board? Sorry, don't like it. They're teaching too much of that goddamn science. They're out. You have a public services commission that said no on the latest nuclear reactor? Sorry, I don't like it. They're out. Oh, my God. Khrushchev, oh, Nikita especially, is just spinning in his glass encased, wherever the hell he is. I don't know where they put Khrushchev's corpse. Whatever. He's spinning because this is all they ever wanted. This is what the Cold War was all about. To go to Michigan and other places and eliminate, with the stroke of a pen, an act by a rubber stamp legislative body to end the democratic process. The threat, you see, has always been from within, Truth Seeker. It has never been from without. The threat to representative government has always been there in the persona of monstrous totalitarians like Rick Snyder. So, here it is. They've already moved into the first dying city, Benton Harbor, Michigan. Governor Rick inserted an EMF or an EFM from his own team to take over the operation of that poor town. But the point I was trying to get to is because of the policies of Governor Rick and the Republicans, teachers are now, not only are they being kicked as part of Rick Snyder's market rate business approach, not only are they being blamed for the miserable output of students, the quality of their education. You don't blame the family environment or the neighborhood environment or the lack of employment or addiction within the family or Christian crazy people. You don't blame any of that when the teacher assumes his or her position in the classroom at 8:30 every morning, no matter what shuffles through the door. That teacher had better, by God, educate it, right? Wrong, of course, wrong. But this is Governor Rick's excuse for ending all sorts of things, including representative government. Now it turns out that teachers in Michigan are becoming eligible for food stamps. School teachers. School teachers. The Union of Teaching Faculty, whatever that is, reports that Central Michigan University professors are now eligible for government assistance. Central Michigan University. These are not elementary school teachers. These are not high school teachers. These are university professors, teachers. How did they become eligible for food stamps? Well, I'll tell you when we come back. Before the hour, Central Michigan University has record assets and revenue, but is allocating money to top administrative salaries, some of those for a medical school that doesn't even exist yet. This is according to PoliticusUSA.com, instead of the underpaid faculty and staff who make CMU work. Patrick McGinnity has a Master of Fine Arts, and he has taught English at CMU for 3 years as a full-time faculty member. Patrick's salary, $24,600 a year. Master's degree on the faculty of Central Michigan University, $24,000 a year is his yearly salary. He's the problem, right? Huh? The university's current pay means that professors like Patrick McGinnity is unable to support his family of four, spouse, two children. So Patrick McGinnity's family relies on government assistance, including WIC, Women, Infants, and Children Feeding Program, and a bridge card, which I believe is something they use in Michigan to keep food on the table. Dr. Mike Evans, Ph.D., and Ken Lee Pebbles are married, CMU faculty members with two children. Ken Lee Pebbles is full-time, and Mike teaches at four other colleges in addition to CMU. Their total income, $40,000 a year. two working people, one of whom has a PhD. Their two children, like Patrick's, Patrick McGinnity, qualify for reduced school lunches, Michigan child health insurance, and other tax-subsidized services. Now, you've got to have a near-poverty-level income to qualify for food stamps, right? As of July 2009, the average monthly benefit, food stamps, was $133.12 per person. Food stamps are paid for in part by the federal government, so it seems small government means relying on federal money to fund cuts to teachers. In other words, everyone who pays taxes is helping to fund Rick Snyder's shift in the distribution of wealth from the middle class to the corporations, so that college professors now qualify for food stamps, medical assistance, school lunches for their kids. Since a portion of food stamp money, according to PoliticusUSA.com, a portion of food stamp money comes from the very same pool as teacher salaries for public institutions, the Michigan, the state portion, you can conclude that Governor Rick Snyder isn't really attempting to address the budget like the freak in Wisconsin, Walker. Like that freak's policies in Wisconsin, Snyder's policies are attempting to disenfranchise an entire class of people. He is using the unilateral and arguably unconstitutional power he granted himself to punish, destroy, disenfranchise, and impoverish or starve certain segments of the population. This is what Stalin did with the massive collectivization of the farms back in the then rather young Soviet Union in the 30s. How many millions of people died because of the policies of one man? Is Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, a Joe Stalin? No, of course not. Although one assumes he probably would like to be. So far, he's proving that he follows that collectivization and destruction policy almost to a T. The only difference, of course, is that Rick Snyder allows for the overlords to be paid the best salaries, get the best cuts of meat on their plate, and so on and so forth. So, as Sarah Jones, writing at PoliticusUSA.com, writes, even though we're so broke, quote, that we can't afford to pay teachers a living wage, we have endless money to enact unconstitutional power grabs and spend the state's money fighting their appeals until they're knocked down. I just wonder, as I always wonder, how long it'll be. What's it going to take? When you now have school teachers who are presented every morning, whether they are preschool, kindergarten, elementary, secondary, or university, you are now presented, if you're a school teacher, with students who are dysfunctional, hungry, tired, stressed out, anxious, depressed, suicidal. Some of them cut themselves, bulimic, as a reaction to what this glorious American culture is doing to them and their families. These kids, as young as 6, as old as 19. There they are. Educate them! And do it on a salary that qualifies you for food stamps. Now, get your ass to work. And if these kids don't turn out in the 99th percentile, every last one of them, then we're going to punish you, the school teacher. We're going to take away your merit pay. We're going to end the idea of tenure. We're going to set up emergency financial managers who can come into your school board and say, you're doing a bad job. You're out of here. Now, bring in the commissars. Wow. Michigan. You know, I remember in September every year. I already said that, didn't I? I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.